Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Past the hour, and we begin. Oh, dear God, here it is. Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. Some of these might sting a little bit, so, you know, look for a soft place to land. This is HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the audio, live, and or podcast version. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is, of course, where you will find the chat room, free and easy to access, and to which you are welcome to participate. You'll also find our shiny new media player at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Jump right in. Choices there between the 48K and 16K streams, depending on how you connect to the interweb tubes. Not a big truck, you know. New and rotating stories every day at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com for your study, your consideration. Pretty good response to the piece that I published yesterday, The Dysfunction That Is West Virginia's Attempted Government. I was just chatting with John Fox at airtime. We've had 1,200 views of the article in 2 days with 800 yesterday, so do feel free to continue sharing it around, please. We have to, somehow or another, keep some focus on this evolving disaster that is life in the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. We will be trying to reach our usual $150 per evening fundraising quota this evening. Thanks very much for actually $140 this evening, because overnight we got some help from Paul. Thank you, Paul, very, very kindly. The way that February works, this is just, you know, nature of the calendar. We will fall short by about $500 if we meet the fundraising goal both tonight and tomorrow night. That's just because of the calendar. The end of February, mercifully, tomorrow. I don't think I could stand it if this year was a leap year in February. Tomorrow will be the end of February, and it'll be... Well, I don't know if you're like me or not, but somehow or another, this has been a long and brutal February. You kind of expect January to be long and brutal, but oftentimes in February, we get a little bit of a break, a little bit of a reminder that we might eventually see spring. March is the month where we expect to see toward the mid or end part of it, we expect to see the first few broad leaves of ramps poking up through the frozen soil, and, well, people around here get excited about those for very good reasons. Really good tonic, and damn good with fried potatoes and beans and scrambled eggs. Makes a lovely soup. You can make a cream soup with ramps instead. Like, you take a recipe for a creamy leek soup, only substitute ramps and a lot less of them. A cream soup with potatoes and, you know, a nice little roux for the thickener and little cubed potatoes and some ramps. Yum, 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 yum. Oh, wow. Thank you, Darlene. Thank you very kindly. Darlene just dropped a note in. She said, been meaning to do this. Sounds like it's a good time to do it right now. $100 challenge. Darlene has offered up $100 to match whatever, to match the $100 coming in from others so that, say, you know, you contribute 10, Darlene will turn it into 20 up to the first $100 that come in, and that would be extremely helpful, very helpful. Thank you very much, Darlene, as we race toward the end of this long, long and frozen February. Thorn in the Side Thursday. Yeah. I saw this earlier today, and it just had Thorn in the Side Thursday written all over it, because it really is. This is, you know, this isn't some little kicker story about some asshole fraternity pledges in Mississippi, or, and that was a serious enough story as it is. Among other things, I got a note from Fritz, who advised me that on the with regard to the Ole Miss story about the noose around the neck of the statue of James Meredith, that on the heels of that, well, we got another one. Fritz pointing out that another fraternity at an SEC member school has gone rogue with a racially themed party back on the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Oh, for pity's sakes. University of Arkansas investigates frat party. University says its investigation found the party on MLK Day included racial stereotypes. Well, surprise, surprise, surprise. Sergeant Carter, who could have ever dreamed of that? But this isn't that kind of Thorn in the Side Thursday story. Oh, wait, mailbag. Hang on. Dr. John with a question. Ramps. They're sort of like nuclear garlic in taste, right? Yeah. They are... actually, I think the word, since we are into the art of knowing words around here, the word ramps comes from, I think, the old English word for garlic, which was, I think, ramseh. R-A-M-S-E-G-H. Ramseh. And if that's the correct pronunciation, I just like to say ramseh. And from that comes the name Ramsey. That's a pretty well-known name hereabouts, Ramsey. In fact, my mother was born at Ramsey, R-A-M-S-E-Y, West Virginia. It's just straight on out the road here from where we live. It's not much of anything anymore, but once upon a time, my grandfather had a store, post office, and sawmill there. And up on a hill above Ramsey was the home of my great, great, great grandfather and my great, great, great grandmother. So, and in terms of taste, yeah, in fact, if you ever visit down here, there is a winery that makes a ramp wine. Only you don't want to be, you know, there's the forever question between, do you serve red wine or white wine, or, you know, what do you serve with pork versus chicken versus fish versus beef versus lamb, that kind of thing. You don't serve ramp wine with anything, but it is a brilliant seasoning agent. I mean, if you would want to saute something in a little bit of white wine, you use this stuff and you get this, whoa, no kidding, ramp flavor, and it is so good, so good. But it's like a cross between onions and garlic, or perhaps leeks and garlic. It's got a very pretty broad leaf that comes up there, and you can eat the leaves, you can eat the roots. Saute them in with a pan of fried potatoes, like I said, a lovely soup. But you have to have a gentle hand in the use thereof, because if you were to throw in, let's say you were making a pot of chili, and you threw in as much ramps as you would throw in onions, you will probably be visited by a hazmat team. They are that strong. So, yeah, a cross between onions, garlic, and absolutely natural and mercifully, the fine folks at Monsanto have not decided that they want to splice any goat inner genes into ramps yet. So there you go. No, but back to Thorn in the Side Thursday. A little something happened in the Senate today. And it's one of those moments that sort of points up the manifest hypocrisy that flows through the very being of America's right wing. Senator Bernie Sanders, who is by far one of the best, most well-intentioned, intelligent, concerned, dedicated members of the United States Senate, Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, a man who God knows I wish was my senator, Senator Bernie Sanders had a bill come up. It was a veterans bill. And this veterans bill had within it $21 billion for medical, education, and job training benefits for veterans who, after the disastrous misadventures of the former president's wars and his, of course, bloodthirsty vice president, have left the VA and veterans generally in rather a bind. This is not a good time to be a veteran. And so Senator Sanders' bill would have tried to alleviate some of those hardships. There are 22 million veterans in the United States. Bear in mind that this bill was about as bipartisan as you could get. Among two dozen different veterans advocacy groups had signed on in support of the legislation. Some Republicans were ready to support it, but not enough. Among other things, contrary to anything that actually made sense, the first thing the Republicans did was to try to kill the bill by attaching Iran sanctions to it that nobody felt like were necessary, or nobody in their right mind. Then today, when it came up for pretty much final consideration, they just said, the Republican Party said, screw the veterans, F them, feed them fish heads. They don't need any $21 billion for medical care, medical coverage. They don't need any $21 billion for education. They don't need any portion of $21 billion for job training. Screw them, because we're poor, right? Now, because one of the things the Republicans always love to complain about is, how are we going to pay for it? Oddly enough, when they were busy passing outrageous tax cuts for the richest people in this country, they forgot to ask that question then. But now that it's somebody's brother, somebody's husband, somebody's father, somebody's uncle, somebody's daughter, somebody's mother, somebody's wife, somebody's sister, now the Republicans are worried about how we're going to pay for it. But Senator Sanders was ready with that too, because he said it could be paid for, and you know, they check these things out before they come to a vote. It could be paid for by the money we're not spending continuing the ungodly, bloodthirsty, blood-sodden, miserable misadventures in Iraq, and hopefully soon we'll be out of Afghanistan. You know what else pissed off the Republicans? The fact that the bill had provisions in it that would open eligibility to more veterans who did not have service-connected injuries that were eligible for treatment at Department of Veterans Affairs facilities. This is all in an Associated Press story by Alan Fram. Here's how you lose a vote. This is the thorn in the side, crazy math that obtains in the Senate of the United States. This measure failed 56 to 41. No, really. Supporters of the measure had 56 votes, and the weirdo opponents of the measure had only 41, and the minority won. Only two Republicans joined in the vote on the right side of history and doing the right thing by veterans. That was Senator Jerry Moran, no really, of Kansas, and Dean Heller from Nevada. Paul Rykoff, who is the founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, said veterans don't have time for this nonsense, and veterans are tired of being used as political chew toys. That's the truth. Who led the charge against people who voluntarily went and took the oath, went through the hellish training, lived the code, put their bodies in harm's way? This is almost too easy. Well, it was Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III of Alabama. Mm-hmm. Yes, that great leader who once said, you know, I thought the Klan was pretty good until I found out they smoked the marijuana. Really. The man who advised a young African-American lawyer in the U.S. Attorney's Office to be careful how you talk around our white women, boy. No, really. Yeah. That Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. The same Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III who gave ringing, full-throated support when George W. Bush wanted to go and attack a country that had not so much as lifted a finger against us in the form of Iraq. That Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III who stood there talking about the nobility of our military. Oh, Irish Dave noting how soon we forget. According to the Gooper accounting, troops are assets. Veterans are liabilities. Thank you. Thank you very much to Jason and to Lottie. We have just met Darlene's challenge. If anybody wants to jump in and help out on picking up the calendrical shortfall of February by matching Jason, well, that would be awfully nice. Thank you very much, Jason. Thank you, Lottie. And thank you, Darlene, for your kind challenge. Gracious sakes. So can we finally, just a question, can we finally take the bloody shirt away from the GOP? Lord God knows they love to wave it. And they talk about how our heritage of service to our country and the nobility of it. But after folks have gotten done serving, get away from me, boy, you bother me. Who the hell are you? Senator Sanders got right frustrated. He said, I have to say this honestly, have a hard time understanding how anyone could vote for tax breaks for billionaires, for millionaires, for large corporations, and then say we don't have the resources to protect our veterans. Senator Sanders, do you really have a hard time understanding that? Senator Sanders, do you not understand that it is in the essence and the nature and the very DNA of the Republican Party to feast on the sacrifices of other Americans? Do you not understand, Senator Sanders, that they are the rankest, filthiest, most vile kind of hypocrites? The kind who thump Bibles but do not read them? The kind who praise troops but do not go and be them? Yeah, America's veterans lost today, 56-41. Can you imagine tuning in a college basketball score and seeing, oh, I don't know, the University of Arizona lost today to the University of California at Los Angeles, 56-41. Oh, no, Arizona had the 56. It was, I believe, according to ancient Greek history, Diogenes. Diogenes the Cynic, he was called, who was known for occasionally walking around with a lamp, trying to find one wise man. Sure am glad he's not around today, because he'd do a hell of a lot of looking in the Republican caucus in the United States Senate. Only two. I mean, think for a minute about all the Republicans in the Senate of the United States who have talked about supporting our troops. I mean, think about Mitch McConnell. Think about Saxby Chambliss of Georgia. You know, he's retiring from the Senate. Remember how Saxby got to the Senate? By smearing Max Cleland and asserting that Max Cleland had bore some sort of similarity to Osama bin Laden. Yeah, Saxby Chambliss, who smeared Max Cleland, couldn't be bothered to vote in favor of America's veterans. How about Richard Burr from North Carolina? Sorry, him neither. Nothing from Bob Corker of Tennessee. Sorry, he couldn't speak up for veterans. Neither could Richard Shelby from Alabama. See how it works? Marco Rubio of Florida, nowhere to be found. Senator Ted, my father anointed me, and I mean my father in heaven, to be King of America, Cruz. Nope, no vote for America's veterans. John McCain, who cannot raise his goddamned arms above his shoulders because he was injured in a plane crash, could not be bothered to vote in favor of America's veterans. Jeff Flake of Arizona, sorry, veterans. Jim Inhofe. Tom Coburn, Oklahoma. Hey, veterans, F you. Mercy sake, somebody get me the smelling salts. Senator Lindsey Graham Cracker, a member of the military his own self, could not be bothered to vote in favor of help for veterans. Rand Paul, sorry. Yeah, on and on and on. Mike Crapo, Idaho. Kansas? Well, one from Kansas. The other one, Pat Roberts. Pat Roberts that's being opposed by a damn teabagger in Kansas as being too liberal? Yeah, he's so liberal he couldn't stand up for veterans who need job training, who need health care access. who need education benefits. Jesus. I mean, this is one of those signpost moments. This is pathetic. And according to this AP article, benefits for some spouses of deceased veterans would have improved, and aid to relatives caring for a wounded veteran would have been expanded to include those who served before the attacks of September 11th, 2001. The Republican Party said, F them! Screw the widows! The hell with them! We chewed their husbands and their wives up in the nasty little wars that we voted so heartily to commit. And now that their wives and their husbands are dead, why should we give a shit about a bunch of widows and widowers? This is the failure of government in the second decade of the 21st century. But because I'm kind of fond of that whole historical perspective thing, this has ever been the problem of cultures that maintained large military forces. Gaius Marius broke precedent in the waning days of the Roman Republic by becoming consul 7 times. Part of his enduring problem lay in the fact that the Republic, which of course was led by the Roman Senate, which was comprised of the wealth class of ancient Rome, was forever wanting the legions to go out to war, preferably wars that brought back lots and lots and lots of loot for the Roman treasury. But when it came time to deal with the legions after the wars were over, those same patricians, those same, well, millionaires and billionaires of their day, said to the veterans, "What do you want from us? You're less than the dirt beneath our sandals. Be gone." And among other things, how to justly and fairly compensate veterans of Rome's adventures abroad became the linchpin, the turning point, upon which circulated the ultimate collapse of the Republic. Gnaeus Pompeius, known as Pompey the Great, he took to calling himself that, it just stuck, I guess, reached an accord with Marcus Licinius Crassus and Gaius Julius Caesar over that express issue. Because once again, Rome's 1% were trying to just throw his veterans out into the cold. Gaius Marius wound up settling some of his veterans on captured lands in what was then what were then the fertile breadbasket areas of North Africa. And of course, eventually, the military got to the point where it ruled the emperor and chose emperors almost at will. And I guess there is so little of that classical learning about which Dr. Bill spoke so eloquently Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week. There is so little of that now, even in the Senate of the United States, that these fools, these abject, absolute, ultimate fools in the Republican Party cannot even begin to understand that taking a big steamer on people who have learned how to wage war and carry weapons might not be the smartest thing to do. In fact, there was a reference in the news story I was looking at about the fact that the Republicans said, well, we don't think this is going to be the central issue of the elections. If I'm not mistaken, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is actually up for re-election in 2014 down in Alabama, Stan. I don't think he has a credible Democratic opponent. So he'll probably get away with this. How sad. How sad. Irish Dave. Come on, Bob. They aren't widows of Confederate veterans or anything. Therefore, nullification! Irish Dave also pointed out, it's as if Bernie Sanders is living in a whole other country, and I don't mean Texas. And that's very true, Jim. Jim pointing out, our veterans, it's always a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. Shame on these bastards. Shame on these bastards who will not speak up for veterans' benefits. You know, we talk sometimes about the social contract, and I guess we sort of view it in esoteric terms. But every now and then we get a rather plain reminder that the terms of the social contract are very, very real. And that there are or should be significant ramifications to violating that social contract. You know, it's often been said that the poor don't have a lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and I think we said that just maybe a week or so ago, and it's true. But while there was a dozen veterans groups who supported this legislation, which one of them will run ads against Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III down in Alabama? How many Alabama? I mean, this is one of those cultural things. Every courthouse, just about, in the South has a statue of a Confederate infantryman or a Confederate cavalryman or a Confederate general or a Confederate private on their courthouse lawn. Thinking back, the statue on the courthouse lawn where I grew up of the Confederate soldier may very well be the very first piece of statuary I ever saw. Oh, okay, a little bit of a correction coming from Randy. Diogenes walked the streets of Greece with a lantern looking for an honest man, not a wise man. You know, ever more reason for Diogenes not to be put in the way-up machine and sent to Washington, D.C. 2014. At least not to the Republican caucus. But this is a part of the social contract. You know, once upon a time we had this thing called the draft, and people like Lyndon Baines Johnson and Richard Nixon wasted the people who were subject to it with real profligacy in the prosecution of the god-awful war of the United States against the people of Vietnam. And so, because so many had been so cruelly wasted, we took the draft away. You could say that it parallels with the Roman, the Roman army started out as an all-volunteer army that could be comprised only of property owners. And it was in the time of Gaius Marius that he said, listen, you know, we've had so many wars and we've lost some, we've lost a few nasty battles. The people who have enough property to arm themselves to go to war is pretty darn thin. So what do you say we make an all-volunteer army and we'll take anybody and we'll equip them? That was met with some significant resistance, but it eventually won the day when it turned out that there were some Gauls that were heading for Rome, and nothing put the dribbling squirts into the Romans like the idea of Gauls at the walls. Well, this is similar to what happened here. We said, okay, no more draft. Too many people resisting it, too many people going to Canada, too many people burning draft cards. It is tearing this country apart. We will go to an all-volunteer military. And we'll make a bargain. The people who come, we will maintain the bargain that to a certain extent that we made with the draftees, that if you serve and serve honorably, that you will be taken care of. What we had today in the Senate of the United States of America was a right-wing Republican renunciation of that contract. I don't know what the responses were of the secretaries of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, or the Commandant of the Marine Corps. But were I any of those, I would be furious. Now, granted, we are, according to the... And you know what? I bet this... In the background of this, I bet there's a little bit of recrimination for the announced downsizing of the United States military. That budget that was announced by Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel the other day, oddly enough... downsizes the military, but at the same time, we managed to keep that flying pile of crap, the F-35, in the budget. Go figure. But the problem is, we have a whole host of veterans who were casually, cruelly, and profligately wasted in the god awful hell holes we created in Iraq and Afghanistan. And to them, the Republican caucus of the Senate of the United States today said, screw you, buddy. So like I said, if I were one of those secretaries, I would be right pissed because I would be inclined to look at Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III and say, son, how in God's name do you expect us to entice young men and women to join the military when they know for a fact that you are going to go back on the word that you as a member of the Congress of the United States have given in the name of the people of the United States to see to their well-being if they can just survive till they get home, or if they don't, that you will take care of the people they loved and who loved them in Jesus! Oh dear. The brutal reminders always come in. Subject line. The social contract? Dr. John, Bob, how quaint of you. Remember your Thatcher. There is no such thing as society. Lawmakers voting against veterans is not that surprising. What's surprising in historical terms is that there will be no consequences for it. The reason? We're well into the second generation of people coming up with no education in social studies, with limited education in history, with no knowledge of the humanities and the social settings in which the great works of art and literature were produced. Add to that no attempt to teach about alternatives to capitalism beyond evil commies! The predictable result is a rejection of the idea that there is value in making and keeping promises to people in our society, and of course, a total faith in authority. If a man in a suit or a uniform says it on television, it must be right and true. And that's a fact. Because if we do decide that we want to go to war with somebody, and sooner or later, there will be some Republican somewhere who needs him a war, or perhaps a Democrat even, maybe even President Obama. And you know what we will do? We will do the same damn thing we did before Iraq and Afghanistan. The very same thing. We will, young people will queue up to join and to go and fight and die and be maimed. This might be a good time to remind people of the brilliant documentary that Phil Donahue was behind. What was it called? Body of War? An individual who joined up after 9/11 to avenge those horrors and finds himself in Iraq and gets shot the first day he goes out in the truck and had his life ruined. Yeah, Marty pointing out, can you say poverty draft, Bob? Kids tend to go to the military when there's no other choice. As the father of an 18-year-old boy with limited choices, I know a little bit about that. We're having those conversations. Now, there will be arguably less poverty draft in the future as a result of this realignment of the military. But it will still be there, and we will still draw a big hunk of our enlisted forces from the poorest communities in the country. It's worth remembering these words. What I said a few moments ago about the next war and how people will run to join up. It was a time of great and exalting excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating. The bands playing. The toy pistols popping. The bunched firecrackers hissing and spluttering. On every hand and far down the receding and fading spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Daily the young volunteers marched down the wide avenue, gay and fine in their new uniforms, the proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotion as they swung by. Nightly the packed mass meetings listened, panting, patriot oratory which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts, and which they interrupted at briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, the tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches the pastors preached devotion to flag and country, and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause, in outpourings of fervid eloquence which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half-dozen rash spirits that ventured to disapprove of the war and cast a doubt upon its righteousness straightaway got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way. Sunday morning came. Next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled, the volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams. Visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then, home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag, or, failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tremendous invocation. God the All-Terrible, thou who ordainest, thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Yeah, that may be Mark Twain from the beginning of the Spanish-American War, but in this country, ain't a damn thing changed. A note coming in from Glenn. I truly believe our military-industrial complex is attempting to run the entire world. Just look at our local police departments. They are outfitted like paramilitary units. They just want to sell to everyone. How sad. But the education of our populace feeds into their paradigm of the world. Irish Dave pointing out, you know, the operative word here is young volunteers. Irish Dave also says, you know, if you can't kill for the military-industrial complex, the least you can do is die. And let's do remember that, I'm told, perhaps it's apocryphal, that in the early original drafts of Eisenhower's speech on the military-industrial complex, he originally called it the military-industrial congressional complex. If true, damned worth remembering. But what Glenn says about paramilitary police, all too true. This story coming out of Columbia, South Carolina, Stan, where police there are sort of, kind of, maybe a little bit lightly investigating a case of a police officer who, he shot a septuagenarian. Oh, really? It was in York County, South Carolina. This is what happens with a militarized police, and who knows how many police officers in this country have some form of PTSD because so many of them served in the unjust and brutal and merciless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. God, the Republicans damn sure don't care. Seventy-year-old Bobby Canipe, C-A-N-I-P-E, from North Carolina, got pulled over by Deputy Terrence Knox of the York County Sheriff's Department. He got pulled over for an expired license plate. Yeah, it's Canipe. He's from Lincolnton, North Carolina, Mr. Canipe is. It was 7:30 p.m. this past Tuesday. He was a little bit north of Clover, South Carolina. And the deputy felt like, well, I guess that the flag would fall, freedom would die, and perhaps anarchy would spread through the streets if a 70-year-old man with an expired plate was allowed to make his way on back home to Lincolnton, North Carolina. Pickup truck. Mr. Knipe was driving a pickup truck. A lot of pickup trucks in America and in the South. They're awful damn handy. So, instructed to exit the car, and we really don't know why. Instructed to exit the car, Bobby Knipe obeyed the 24-year-old police or sheriff's deputy's order. But, you know, when you're 70 years old and you spent a lifetime to one degree or another carrying America's wealth class on your back, whether you were a store clerk or a furnace worker or a lineman or whatever it was in the world you did. Well, by 70 years old, sometimes you don't get around so daggum good. Sometimes you can drive in the truck, but you need a little help when you go to get around. And so as you walk up to get in your truck, you toss your walking stick in the back of the truck, and you get on in and you drive away. Well, Bobby Knipe obeyed the deputy's order, got out of the truck, and reached into the back of the truck for his, wait for it, walking stick, which at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, the 25th day of February, Deputy Knox of the York County, South Carolina Sheriff's Deputy's Office could not distinguish as not being a high-powered rifle. So, unable to tell that Mr. Knipe, who was 70 and hobbling, might need a walking stick, Deputy Knox decided instead to shoot the 70-year-old. Because you never know when a pointed stick is going to be a deadly weapon.
How to defend yourself against anyone who attacks you armed with a piece of fresh fruit.
You promised you wouldn't do fruit this week.
What do you mean?
Well, we've done fresh fruit for the last 9 weeks.
What's wrong with fruit? You think you know it all, eh?
Well, can't we do something else for a change?
Like someone who attacks you with a pointed stick.
Pointed sticks? Oh, we want to learn how to defend ourselves against pointed sticks, do we? Getting all iron mighty, eh? Fish fruit not good enough for you, eh? Well, I'll tell you something, my lad. When you're walking home tonight and some homicidal maniac comes after you with a bunch of Logan Brace, don't come trying to leave.
Yeah. I guess there's a reason we don't teach law officers in the United States of America down in York County, South Carolina, stand to defend against pointed sticks. But, you know, there's an insane balance here, or imbalance, if you will. And that is that young 24-year-old kids who have had maybe 6 weeks in the state police academy and are then turned loose with deadly weapons and very powerful automobiles, are taught along the way that, you know, we got a lot of guns in this country, and you got to be real careful because you never know when you're just going to pull somebody over and you're all by yourself and somebody's just going to start taking shots at you. So we're scared of the cops, and the cops are scared of us, and more often than not, the cops have the guns, while the 70-year-olds have the walking sticks. Heavens to Betsy. Irish Dave pointing out, that walking stick could have been the same shotgun that kid in Florida pointed at the lone gunman. True enough, Irish Dave. Did Mr. Knipe have his long-form birth certificate proving he was really 70 years old to also photo ID? Now, the story gets sicker. It's not like young Deputy Knox was a sure shot. He discharged several, the word used is several, he discharged several rounds from his service weapon in the general direction of Mr. Knipe in what can only be described as point-blank range. Mercifully, young Deputy Knox did not manage to kill Mr. Knipe. He merely maimed him. Then comes York County Sheriff spokesperson Trent Farris, who, asked to comment upon the maiming of 70-year-old Mr. Knipe, remarked, "The situation is very unfortunate. It does appear at this time that Deputy Knox's actions were an appropriate response to what he reasonably believed to be an imminent threat to his life." With a pointed stick. I love the language of the article. The victim was taken to a hospital in Charlotte, North Carolina, where he is expected to survive. From out here in the gardens of the land of the art of knowing words, there's a big difference between writing that as where he is expected to live versus he is expected to survive. Oh, yeah. One wonders if he'll do any more hobbling around on his little walking stick. Don't know. Maybe he just winged him. Where he will survive. So here ends the filibobster for this evening's Thorn in the Side Thursday. There are more thorns. Note coming in from Glenn. It's the way the police are being trained. Everyone is a suspect, and everyone is a potential criminal. Right, because we're going to save that whole innocent until proven guilty thing until the lawyers get hold of it. Oops. Steve in China with a note. Vets and debts. Old soldiers never die, but sometimes they become a confounding burden on the well-heeled warlords of the Senate. Speaking as a veteran, I thought there was a limit to feeling ashamed about what my nation's noble experiment in liberty has become. I'm just a little more ashamed today. Carry on. Signed, Steve in China. Carry on. The sad thing is, we're the ones who feel the shame. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III and Lindsey Graham Cracker and Richard Shelby and Saxby Chambliss and Thad Cochran and Marco Rubio and Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and Ted Cruz and all the rest of those weirdos, they are incapable of feeling shame. And instead, somehow, it devolves onto us. And that, all by its lonesome self, is a damned shame. Again, thanks go out this evening to Darlene for getting us started with a challenge and to Lottie and Jason for answering it. If anyone wants to answer Lottie and Jason and take care of tomorrow and maybe get after what will be a hole that the calendar caused and not anything else, you're more than welcome. It is much appreciated. Jack in Shreveport writing, cops and shooting. Bob, what popped into my head while you were talking about the story where the cop shot the old guy that was getting his walking stick out of his truck was how our military has to train people to kill other people. People are not born having the propensity to kill other folks. Therefore, I'm thinking that the training for our police forces are way out of bounds as to what reasonable people would think is reasonable. Yep, Glenn just said it. Cops are being trained in a way we just can't agree with. Remember that cop that sprayed mace, etc., into those students' faces as if it was nothing? Yeah, I do. And I think he got a big settlement out of it, didn't he? Did I read that right? Yeah. So we will take our top-of-the-hour break and open up the phone lines if you wish to comment, carry on, or bring something else to the table. You are more than welcome so to do. To reach the program, you know, of course, the number is 304-658-3333. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. If you've never used the magic of the Skype, send me a contact request. I'll approve it, and we'll be chatting in no time at all. Green News Report is on the way. What with this being Thursday, the 27th day of February 2014 and all, I'm looking forward to it. I hope you are, too. This is Conversation Radio. It is radio like no other. And I'm Bob Kincaid.
I play stereo loud when I'm away from the maddening crowd, smoking, joking, clowns we all are. Sometimes kinda get real ill when I receive my monthly telephone bill. But you say it and I'll pay it, 'cause it just helps me to survive. Till I see you again. And there are mountains below. Been a while since I've seen any snow. It's chilling, so thrilling, so good to be back. Feels nice to be home for a while. Let's sip champagne to
It's Thursday, February 27, 2014.
The health impacts of tar sands oil are being ignored.
Cancer clusters found downwind of Canada's tar sands. Federal judge rejects Keystone XL pipeline route through Nebraska. Inspector General finds no conflict of interest in Keystone XL environmental report. Tesla wants to free you from your electric utility, plus...
These turbines would pay for themselves over time, but because they're used year-round to generate electricity, they just serve an additional benefit to reduce the damage of hurricanes.
Can wind turbines really slow down hurricanes?
No. All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
In the Middle Ages, it was witchcraft. You would attribute adverse weather events to witchcraft. Now, it's just we just have CO2.
Wait, so CNBC's Joe Kernan says climate change is not due to CO2, it's due to witchcraft? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it's very bizarre, but last night this water fell from the skies out here in Los Angeles. It's been literally 2 years since we've seen that happen. We're in the middle of the worst drought ever out here in California. I forgot how nice it was when it rains.
Yeah, rain is neat, isn't it?
It is. Now, speaking of neat, how about you and your climate change witchcraft? What do you have for us today?
Well, first, some very big developments for the Keystone XL pipeline. In a setback for opponents of the proposed pipeline, the Inspector General of the State Department has rejected allegations of conflict of interest against the contractor who wrote the pipeline's environmental impact report, even though the Inspector General agrees the contractor did not fully disclose their extensive relationship with pipeline owner TransCanada.
So the company that created this environmental report that essentially found, oh, no big problem with the Keystone. They had done work with TransCanada, didn't tell the government about it, but now the Inspector General says, no problem, no conflict of interest there.
Right.
Okay.
Since the contractor mostly followed the rules, it's okay. You can check out the long list of conflicts for yourself at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
I think I'm going to just mostly pay my taxes this year.
But in other Keystone news, a federal judge has thrown out the revised route for the controversial pipeline across Nebraska, agreeing with Nebraska landowners that their Republican governor and legislature did not have the legal authority to ram through approval of the new route around the sensitive Sand Hills region.
That was after the Republican governor and legislature blocked the original route for the Keystone XL pipeline.
That's right. Now the judge has thrown out the new route, meaning that pipeline owner TransCanada is barred from seizing private lands through eminent domain, at least for the moment.
Wait, eminent domain? I thought Republicans were against eminent domain.
Yeah, they like to pick and choose. Meanwhile, Democratic Senators Barbara Boxer and Sheldon Whitehouse are calling for the Obama administration to do a comprehensive public health impact study of the dirty tar sands oil that would be transported across the U.S. by the proposed pipeline. At a press conference this week, Dr. John O'Connor, a family doctor practicing downwind of Alberta's tar sands, says he is seeing much, much higher rates of cancers in his community. He says a recent cancer board study found a 40% higher rate of cancer.
This represents a public health crisis in this community.
So I keep hearing all of these reasons to not build the Tar Sands XL pipeline. The only thing I haven't heard is, what reason is there to build it at this point?
Pretty much money and greed. Lots of profits to be made.
Not by us, though. By
Canada.
Canada, right. So, I'm sorry, I just don't get it.
In clean tech news, Stanford University researchers, using computer models to figure out how offshore wind turbines would hold up in hurricanes, say they were shocked to discover that those offshore wind turbines could actually reduce hurricane winds and storm surge, says study author Mark Jacobson.
We found that large arrays of offshore wind turbines could not only reduce wind speeds of the hurricane by up to 50%, but also storm surge by anywhere from 6 or 7 to 80%, thereby reducing the storm damage.
That's a pretty big deal. These are just numerical computer models, but they do bring up some interesting questions.
So the turbines create energy most of the time when there's a hurricane coming through. He's saying they help to break up and slow down the hurricane?
Yeah, it seems pretty crazy.
Yeah, count me dubious.
Finally, electric car maker Tesla announced this week it will build the world's largest battery factory in the U.S. and is going to use the Tesla's battery technology to develop a home-based energy storage system that would work with rooftop solar panels. Lots of questions remain about this plan, but it could further disrupt the monopoly currently enjoyed by the big central electric utility companies.
And put all of those people in China out of work. Why does Elon Musk hate China? For much more on that and the rest of the stories we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Please consider a donation to help us stay on the air. It is our fifth anniversary. Plus, you can download us anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Love that song. 13 minutes past the hour, 13 minutes past 7 p.m. here on the in the Eastern time zone. And, of course, that only counts if you're listening live. For the podcast audience, it's whatever time you need it to be. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. And let's see. Let's go to the phones. Line's open, by the way, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, Bob. How are you?
Oh, Bill, I'm great. How about you?
Well, I've been told that in the past, but some of these women were liars, and what can I tell you? Anyway, it went straight, you know. Some of the music critics, too, say they were lying. So, you get enough liars, you start to believe in them. Hell, you even believe yourself when you throw the when you become a Spanish athlete, you know. Yeah, I got lost tonight because a buddy of mine called me, and because we just had bid on a Sea Crane radio on the, if you know what those are.
I do.
Yeah. Because mine is giving me some trouble. I tried to get my buddy to take it to a friend of mine who's a master. Because one thing I do know is electronic repair, and I know who was good and I know who was better. And there was a lot of guys that were better than me. You know, I hate to say that, but some of those guys, I think, were born with a voltmeter sticking out of their ear. They just had a knack. Well, my dad's brother, he was like that. One of the guys in the guys he worked for in that association.
Yes, yes. The Benevolent and Protective Association? Yes.
The man with the golden hands, because if it was electric and it was repairable, he could do it. That's why when he called me over in his old age to bring a picture tube device over and Goose's picture tube. You connect it up to it and you run a current through it and you burn some of the crap off of the circuits that were carrying the picture. You know how that electronics works. You get a buildup of crud that'll take away the quality. So I'm doing that for him and saying, Jesus, Bill, he's either gotten real old or you've you know, for him to call me to do something was amazing to me. But at least he trusted his nephew enough to do it. And his TV still worked when I was done, so I guess it was correct. But the theme tonight, what I heard was you were listing the Southern senators by name.
Yeah, the ones who voted against the veterans, right.
What in the hell? How did they get away with it, Bob? How? How stupid are my fellow Americans when you see these guys who are the biggest goddamn warmongers we have in the goddamn Congress, and yet they don't want to pay for the price? But that goes back again. We go back to the Civil War when there was no, hell, you couldn't even, they didn't even have cooking.
Yeah, but understand, after the Civil War, the various legislatures of the various Confederate, formerly treasonous states in rebellion, had no problem appropriating some kind of funds for at least a bare minimum maintenance of their veterans.
Yeah.
This country now has even abandoned that.
Yeah. That just really hurts. I mean, it just, First of all, it hurts the guys who did it and what we called upon them to do. And but they did it a lot to the Vietnam era guys, too. The a friend of mine's husband died of Agent Orange poisoning, you know?
Yeah.
And they tried to deny that like crazy, too. So it isn't a brand new situation, you know? It's something that, like you say, it's been done. I mean, the whole, hell, the Civil War, you know what size the U.S. Army was in 1860? About 15,000 plus men.
Yeah, it hadn't changed in size during peacetime. You know, the ranks swelled during times of war, but during peacetime, it hadn't changed that much from what it was at the beginning of the 19th century.
Well, that's why so many of the men on both sides, it was always such and such was the 1st Virginia was a big name unit in Lee's army, and the 24th Michigan, and a
but,
couple others.
Yeah, but understand that up until 1861, the government of the United States maintained a very, very healthy fear and respect for a huge standing army.
Well, I grew up
for good reason.
I grew up hearing that kind of talk from people in my family. Two of my cousins who were older than me, they had almost a pleasure trip through Germany. The Germans on the Western Front were, a lot of them were just hanging it up, you know, or they were being shipped to stop the Russians. They were going to, that crazy Hitler thought he could beat the Russians up until the last minute of the war. So, insanity is so, but for these guys, I mean, isn't there any publicity released about this situation? Are you the only guy talking about it?
I hope I'm not. I mean, there was obviously an Associated Press story about it, but the question is the degree to which anybody can be made to pay a price. You know, the nation does not vote. The whole nation doesn't have to agree by a simple majority on whether Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III gets to keep being a senator. That's up to the people of the state of Alabama.
Well,
and the same for the two Jaspers in Oklahoma. Now Coburn says he's resigned. You know, he's done. But Inhofe's going to keep going. John McCain, how dare he?
Yeah. Well, his father and his grandfather were both U.S. admirals.
But remember, John McCain, too, was a member of the officer class.
Yep.
And I would suspect that most of the people who will get most of the benefits were from the out of this bill would be from the enlisted ranks. So, you know, there's that sort of wrong, that sort of elitism probably at work, too. Because John McCain nor his family have ever been particularly concerned with anything but, you know, McCain's.
Well, I understand there was an episode he had coming off of a flight deck, and he dumped a plane in the water.
He was not a particularly good pilot. Isn't there some speculation that he was responsible, at least in part, for the fire aboard the Forrestal?
Yep. Forrestal, that's another one. You familiar with that guy's story?
Yeah.
Yeah, what did he do, wig out? During Truman's administration, the guy was, people were following him, and now sometimes you wonder, was he really a whack job, or were people following him? Because the way the government seems to act anymore, stuff happens, shall we say.
Yeah.
Because you begin to, when there's the stuff that we've seen go on in the last 10 years for sure, you know, just out and out, you begin to scratch your head and say, are you nuts or am I? Of course, you got to excuse me as I sit here and drink this good coffee that I just got in IBEC today.
Oh, rub it in, sure,
yeah,
I understand.
Yeah, this stuff, I ought to be able to run around here in an hour or so. I ought to be running up and down the hallways.
That's why I'm into the decaf.
Yeah.
I get caffeine in me and bad things happen.
Well, I used to take three quart thermoses to a job. I'd stand there all night drinking coffee, and it must have confused me because I'd go out on a break and somebody would hand me a cigarette that had no name on it. My poor people having to roll their own, you know, it's, what can I tell you? Of course, you felt pretty good, too, after that. And, well, I'm just so, you know, I'm so delighted that I ever started calling you because one or two of the guys heard me talking that night and said, there's something wrong with Bill. It doesn't sound like him.
Yep.
I mean, I'm a little wacko.
Oh, we all knew. I mean,
God almighty.
Yeah. But it's nothing to feel bad about, and I'm.
Well, they went in that night and stopped it within an hour. That's why I'm so damn lucky that that somebody got me in there. Because me, I'd have gone and went to sleep and woke up the next morning wondering, who am I and where am I? You know, that kind of situation.
Well, if you had, you know,
to these yahoos, this has been going on for years and years in this country, and. That's why I love one of these days. Dr. Bill would be the kind of guy I could, man, I'd buy a 12-pack to be able to sit and talk to him. And I'm notoriously cheap.
Well, but you know what? You get the chance 3 days a week. Anytime you want to call in and carry on, you're more than welcome.
Yeah, well, I'm so intimidated by that man.
Now quit. What?
I mean, he doesn't intimidate you. It's my own lack of knowledge and education.
No. You've got plenty that you have pursued on your own hook, which is sometimes the best kind.
Well, that was the old-fashioned American way.
But the thing is, you're not the only one to say that. Dr. Bill adores conversation far, and he's like me in that regard. He would far rather have a conversation about a topic than to sit and pontificate about one. And he doesn't pontificate in the first place.
No,
he's trying to create that dialogue because, you know, that's how learning and wisdom is achieved and arrived at, not by someone sitting and spouting great noble truths at someone else. The dialogue is the process whereby real learning occurs. And you are not the first. You will not be the last. And, in fact, there are many who say, you know, I don't want to interrupt Dr. Bill.
Yeah.
Dr. Bill wants to be interrupted.
Well, I will, you know, talk to him now and then. But he's taught me, I mean, Bob, I know a lot of American history, but the constitutional part of it seemed to wash right over me. Even the Revolutionary War, although I'm hip to the plan the British had, Burgoyne was supposed to come down out of Canada, and they had this whole freeway plan worked out for the New York State area, and somehow or other they got beat. I'm not convinced that George Washington was a great general.
Very few people are.
Yeah, well, that's good to know.
Because he wasn't.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I think, I've had friends of mine who were back in the 60s, who were actually, one of my buddies was what they called a red diaper baby. His folks had been CP members in New York City, and they got the hell out of there when the shit was hitting the fan in the early 50s for those people. You know, when the pretty boy from Wisconsin?
Yeah,
the one we can't confuse with the other one.
Yeah, Tail Gunner Joe.
Yeah. Yeah, when he was shooting his mouth off, a lot of people, Dashiell Hammett went to jail because he refused to give out names. And, you know, there was a lot of that going on. The Birchers, they were active around here. I went to a couple of their lectures, and after the guy was done, we started hitting him with questions that were embarrassing to him, and, you know.
Well, you've got a vote of confidence coming in from Dr. John. He says, I would love to hear the two Bills converse.
Well, he's got it. I mean, he also
adds, I know what Bill means, but I've talked to Dr. Bill three times, and he's even more gracious and welcoming than Bob is.
Oh, he is great. I mean, he's just fantastic. And Professor Lilly, I've not heard enough of his stuff, and I can't even, my old computer does not function well on the net. I don't have email. But the guy I talked to tonight who ordered the radio and purchased it for me, and who I'll see next week, he put a hard drive in my old one, Well, the old one was the one he gave me that he had built himself. So he had no trouble getting it back together again, but we'll have to go from there. In fact, I've ordered, and I hope I get it, is a new copy of Zoom Text, which is this program that... But my buddy Colin, I think you guys know who he is by
yeah,
now.
Yeah,
yeah. He wants to get me a new computer, but I'm so goddamn lazy, Bob, I don't want to have to learn anything new. Give me a break. Too goddamn old. Well, you know, I had the same, I had two of them with the same program that you were running.
Yeah, XP, sure.
And XP, I think, is a better program than a lot of the stuff that came after it.
Seven, once you get used to it, and for me, there's only two or three things that really mess with my mind, and one of which is the audio interface. Once you get used to it, it's okay. I'm still not okay with 8, at least not the way it runs on a desktop, but that may be because it's running on a desktop that needs more computing power than what we really have.
Yeah, well, everybody's telling me that get a laptop, forget that old stuff and blah, blah, but I don't know. I'm not sold on those things. I have this funny feeling about industry. When they're on a roll, they'll find ways to cheapen everything. They'll find ways to increase their profit margin by cutting the quality of what they're giving you. My mother, my granddad bought a TV in 49, and I watched my mother put a new black and white tube in the damn thing.
From where I sit, I'm much, everything we're using here, with the exception of the laptops, is something I was taught to build. And I much prefer to build my own machine and use parts that I know are of high quality, because one of the things that you run across is that mass-produced desktops and, you know, laptops too, although I don't know much about them, they'll use a lowest common denominator motherboard or a, you know, crap memory or a slow hard drive, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating.
Well, I was building the damn things, assembling them for a friend of mine in the early 90s, and I forget what number it was. What the computer was, because he was installing him in people's businesses and such, and I would assemble, and he'd what do they call it when you make the hardware and the software work together? There was a name for that process. I don't know if you have to do much of it anymore.
Oh, a lot of it is largely plug and play now. You just have to make sure that, you know, you've got the right memory for the right CPU and the right motherboard and.
Well, what were they building in? What was I building in 90? It was 90 and 91.
Oh, golly Moses. That's before even the Pentium processor comes out. So it's
Pentium wasn't around yet.
Yeah, it was probably some sort of 286 processor unit.
Yeah, that's what it was. But there was a name for the system.
Windows 3.1 for warehouses?
It was 3.1, yeah. It was what the thing turned out to be. And my second wife had done a lot of stuff on the big computers at Cleveland State University. So she was way ahead of me on that. I mean, I didn't start messing with it myself until the 90s, so, you know.
Well, by the way, you're getting fan mail in from Tim from L.A. He says, tell Mr. Stress to get an Apple, and he gives me a winking smiley face.
Well, he...
That's a great idea, but, you know, the problem is the Apple tax. And that is the premium that you pay for being able to purchase an Apple.
Yeah.
As compared to a PC.
Well, I've heard those words, though, over and over again from friends of mine all over the country who have the darn things. They love them.
But Tim also adds, Bill, he says, as for conversing with Dr. Bill, Mr. Stress, in my opinion, is by far a lot more knowledgeable than Tom Hartman, and he would do really well with the doc.
Well, you know, I in the daytime, I'll pick up a station out of Chicago, and I'll listen to press in the morning, and Stephanie, and at least one thing about Stephanie and the people she works with, you will laugh a lot.
Oh, and everybody needs a laugh.
And I should talk to her one of these days, because you know what her father's name was.
Yeah.
Because I caught hell that year from her. I didn't know you were a Republican running for the vice presidency, and you know how it is with people. If they find they find a thing they can jab you with. You hear it over and over again. You can almost tell when they walk up to you what they're going to say. You can almost predict it. Well, that's like me. I usually can predict, I can usually talk about something that's happened in our past that, you know, it's just coming back to haunt us. These people never give up.
Hey, by the way, we've got a suggestion coming in from Darlene for you. Knowing how much you love to read, experience books, Darlene reminds us, there's that book that Dr. Bill recommended to me when I called in a few times. He suggested Woody Holton's Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Darlene says, I don't know if there's an audio version for Mr. Stress, but I did get it on Kindle for about $10, and it's very interesting, an easy read. Dr. Bill said he refers to that book quite often, and it might help Mr. Stress fill that knowledge gap he said he had about the Constitution.
Yeah, because it was what they taught. I mean, Bob, it's unbelievable what they taught us in the eighth grade about the labor unions and such and how they were castigated.
Did they actually teach you that unions were good things?
Yeah, at that time they did, yeah.
See, that's the problem in the modern era. If they teach an eighth grader about unions at all, it is to teach eighth graders that unions are bad, 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 awful, terrible, no good, really bad,
communist,
Bolshevik,
yeah,
horrible America-hating institutions that help Americans make more money than they should ever be able to make. And it's disgusting. By the way, a P.S. From Darlene, she says, I'm completely a flub-dub on the radio, which is a lie. She's great. Yet Dr. Bill made me feel comfortable. It was a great informative conversation that I had with him.
I talked to him once, because so many of the things that he brings up, they're jumping out every day and slapping us in the face. Because in order to get that Constitution signed, the country had to go along with slavery. Now, how in the hell could anybody, I don't care what the guy looked like, how much melatonin he had, or he wore feathers in his hair, and they tried to make slaves out of them too.
Yeah, well, part of the reason for the importation of African slaves it lies in the fact that the people who had been living here for 15,000 years simply refused to participate and would rather have died.
Yeah,
and did by the millions.
Well, they sure did. I remember the. I was playing in Knoxville one time, and they had a convention of people, I think mostly Cherokee, that were down there at the time for this American Indian Convention.
Oh, by the way, Fritz in Arkansas said, those dinosaur PCs Mr. Stress was building were probably 386s and 486s with 1,200 and 2,400 kbps modems running Win 3.1 DOS.
Yep, that's what they were running. And the guy that was building him had been a TV guy, and he was also a musician with a metal band in Cleveland area, and, you know, I got to know him pretty well. In fact, he was on that Killer Stress on the CD, the one that I'm standing in front of the old car with the shotgun and the white hat and the black shirt and white tie. I mean, that's my sense of humor.
I've got it right here.
Yeah. I mean, that whole thing, killer, you know, the use of the term killer in musical circles is... And in a lot of other ones, it means it's good. It'll knock you on your seat, you know, musically. And I was so damn lucky, Bob, I used to listen to this guy, Bill Randall, in the 50s. And one night at a place called the Brick Cottage, when I was working there, he comes into the place with his daughter, and he says in a very loud voice, this guy plays as well as Paul Butterfield. And, of course, I just about fell over at the time to hear. Because Randall was bringing Elvis Presley around Cleveland in 55. High schools he brought him to. Randall was a very shrewd guy. He was, he had been a DJ out of Detroit back in the 40s. And he would record people. As one guy put it, everybody from John Lewis, who was beside being a congressman, he was the name of a guy who played piano for the Modern Jazz Quartet. And George Lewis, who's a great New Orleans clarinet player, so there's a pretty big extreme. I was lucky. I hung out in a neighborhood that might have been called a red light district when I was 17, 18 years old. and the guys were hammering organs in the front window. All that Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff stuff, just lifting me out of my shoes, you know? I mean, exposure. And living in a housing project where the neighbors were playing the strange-sounding stuff where the first line repeats all the time. What is that stuff, anyhow? there are a lot of positive things about our society. And that was, for me, was one of them. And for a lot of people, like, I'm so crazy. There's a really good book titled Only the Ball Was White. It's great history of the old leagues. And there were guys that were so good that never got a chance to play in the majors.
Josh Gibson?
Here, right away. So you got it. Who was the other guy? There was another hitter that was real big. I don't know if it was Gibson or one of the other guys. They were playing in Pittsburgh, and he hits a ball so far. I think I told you this. When he was out, the ball was out of sight. And the next day they're playing in Philly, and the Philadelphia center fielder takes a ball he had hidden, throws it up the air, and the catches it, and the umpire turns to the batter and says, hey, you're out yesterday in Pittsburgh. In other words, the ball came down in Philly. These guys were, and it was such an interesting, almost every form of sports has an undercurrent to it. I know guys that hung out with pro wrestlers and saw things go on between those guys. They all, after they have matches in Akron on a Saturday night, they'd all go down to one of that one famous steakhouse, you know, the cheap steakhouse, National. Brown Derby.
Huh?
We had the Brown Derby is what they called it up here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think they were National, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a Hollywood institution or something.
Yeah, I think that's where it's. Well, that was a nightclub in Hollywood. Yeah, used that name.
Oh, this was a different. Okay.
Yeah, they used the name. Of course, one of my stories that I point at it constantly for was the, I think it was Boston University was playing for the national title in 42. Paul Brown wrote about that in his biography. And they lost, I think, to Holy Cross. They were knocked out of the number one spot in college football. And those guys had a party schedule because if they finished on top of the college standings, they were going to go out to a nightclub in Boston. The nightclub was called the Coconut Grove.
Oh.
And you're familiar with the Coconut Grove.
Oh yeah. I'm getting some queries about the other baseball player besides Josh. Are you talking about Oscar Charleston, Cool Papa Bell?
Yeah, Cool Papa Bell is who I'm thinking of, but Oscar Charleston I'm familiar with too. I've got to get that book.
Lifetime batting average of .348.
Yep. Well, we got lucky. Bill Veeck signed Satchel Paige in 48.
Yeah.
And Paige won 6 games.
Yeah, Bill Veeck was not going to be left behind by the likes of Branch Rickey.
Yeah. Well, Paige went 6-1, I think, in the 48 season. Remember, the Indians finished in a dead tie with the Boston Red Sox. That would have been, if Boston Red Sox had won the playoff, it would have been Boston versus Boston.
I mean, the numbers on Satchel Paige are amazing.
Oh, yeah.
He threw a 12-inning shutout at the age of 46 for the St. Louis Browns in 1952.
Yep. I think Veeck owned the St. Louis Browns at that time.
Let's see, 3 scoreless innings for the Kansas City Athletics at age 59.
Yep. He was an amazing player. He actually was half-kidnapped by Batista to go pitch for Batista's national team that Batista was using, because Latin Americans, as we know today, who runs Major League Baseball, personnel-wise? Those guys got a handle on that game now.
Oh, sure.
The guy that Oscar, what was his name? It was not Oscar, but a guy that played shortstop for the Indians in the 80s and 90s. God almighty. Omar. Biscal.
Yeah, Omar.
What a player. What a fielder. I mean, he one-hand stuff that was coming off the ground. And you can imagine, these kids who were playing in Latin America, they must have played on ball fields that were the roughest of the rough. You ever play infield and you got your eyes on a ground ball, and all of a sudden it hits a rock, changes direction, and hits you in the face.
Actually, I spent most of my time behind the plate, so.
You too. I did a lot of that.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. Well, I used to have this thing
about
find a job that nobody wants and grab it. Because most people were, they didn't think it was a very glamorous position.
Oh, I thought it was the coolest position in baseball because you got to command the whole field.
Yeah. You were, what hurt me, the coaches when I was a kid were saying you've got the defensive talents, but he said, well, what for my problem was my right arm, my grandmother could have stolen second base. And, Paul would have got there 2 feet behind her. That was a weakness. And luckily it didn't show up too much as a kid. Because a lot of those games that I played, and they didn't allow it. They didn't allow stealing. Because it was too common with young kids. Plus, the truth of the matter is that these kids, I think, are starting to throw curves and such too early. And arms are frying on some of these young guys. It's the old story.
Well, that's because they lay out so incredibly much money for a pitcher, then they feel like they're wasting their money if they give him 2 or 3 years in the minors to actually learn how to pitch.
Yeah.
There was a book back in the 90s. I think it was by Whitey Herzog, or maybe it was Earl Weaver.
Weaver. Yeah,
talking about all the things that are no longer taught in the minors that any competent baseball player needs to know.
Yeah, true.
Because the minors were a developmental league.
Yeah.
And, in the era of massive signing bonuses, if some kid's sitting around the minor leagues, working on a curveball that won't destroy his elbow, well, that's money wasted. I mean, what if he does destroy his elbow? And of course, the classic fairly modern case in point is, of course, Kerry Wood with the Cubs.
Yeah.
They absolutely turned his arm into jello.
Because if he doesn't make it, you don't have to pay him anyway. And that's the only thing, to see the actual participants get better control of, I think Graham was, Otto was paid $25,000 by the Browns in his heyday. And that's why I'm so spoiled when it comes to football. I caught Otto's last 2 years in the game and, it just when you read Paul Brown's book and you saw that they won the Eastern Division every year from 50 through 55, it's like,
Yeah.
And it was much more of a game than it is today. It's more TV, television. If it wasn't for television, the American Football League might have not have survived. Television money kept them going when. I've seen some of the uniforms. If you can find an old copy of the Denver Broncos uniform from the early days, it's like it was almost comical because the TV money is what kept that league going and the whole thing. That's a problem being a hockey fan, which has not caught on with most Americans. It's a funny game. If you don't see it enough live, it's just too damn fast for television. It's just too quick for television. And plus, although it's starting to, on the West Coast, I used to get a laugh a couple of years ago. There was a couple of guys with very, very much Latin American names, from maybe Canada or the West Coast that were playing the game. And the amount of Russians, of course, and Germans and Swedes. Holy God!
You've really started a baseball discussion here, and I guess that's a sign that spring is on the way.
Yeah.
Irish Dave pointing out, he said, I can't remember if it was Gibson or Bell. It was Cool Papa Bell that they said was so fast he could turn out the light and be in bed before the room was dark.
Yeah.
And Marty wants you to know. He said, yeah, I played first base on fields like that. He said, I also pitched. Catcher's a cool position, but the convention, no lefties behind the plate.
Yeah, very true. I don't think there's ever been one that I can think of.
I don't even know if they manufacture a left-handed catcher's mitt.
Yeah, because of that.
Because back when I started teaching Ferg to play baseball, when he was a baby, just able to sit up. I mean, I literally sat on the living room floor with him, rolling a baseball to him and getting him to roll it back to me.
Yep.
And you know, as he got older, you know, what position did you play, Dad? Catcher. Oh, I want to play catcher. Yeah, it's kind of sweet. Fathers, sons. And no, son, you're left-handed. You know, God put a little cannon on your left shoulder.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why there are, well, a left-handed catcher would be a liability given the number of right-handed batters in terms of making throws on attempted putouts on steals, wouldn't he?
Well, you just
and the other thing is you don't waste left arms.
No. And first base is a natural position for a left-handed.
And I guess, you know, I guess we'll push it out another generation waiting for that waiting for that great pitcher, but yeah. Because you know, yeah. I was named after a pitcher.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. My father badly wanted a pitcher, and he got a catcher. I got a left-hander who's not going to be a pitcher. So we'll just see how the you know we'll just keep turning the crank and see how the tumbrils fall.
Who do you name me after?
Robin Roberts.
Oh, yeah. I remember the 19 vaguely. I still remember the 1950 Philadelphia, the Whiz Kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was one of them.
And bless his heart, his control was so impeccable that it got to the point where hitters would just dig in against him because they knew that if he sent the ball within a centimeter of the longest hair on their chin, that he meant for it to be there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, just dig in.
And see, now you bring up a name in my memory of a guy pitched for New York and I believe Brooklyn both in his career. They call him the barber, Sal Magley.
Yep.
Because he would put that ball around your chin like he was giving you a shave. Yeah, that was an amazing thing.
And Marty points out as well that with mention of Kerry Wood, he said, "Yeah, the Nationals are trying to do the same thing with Steve Strasburg." And we, you know, I've talked about that with some Nationals fans up in D.C.
Yeah.
They're going to turn his arm into mush.
Well, during that heyday, you know, the old Senators, who was there? Walter Johnson was the guy.
Big Train.
Otherwise, the expression in the 50s was Washington, first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. That was what you heard lots of.
Oh, I love some of that stuff, Bill. You know, Bing Crosby owned an interest in the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah.
And from time to time, Bob Hope would serenade him.
Yeah.
There was an old, popular song called "There's a Barbershop on the Corner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania."
There's a pawn shop.
A pawn shop.
Pennsylvania, that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That, so you know it, okay?
Yeah, I heard all of it.
Well, Hope would sing because during the time the. The Pirates were, as they have been in the last 15, terrible, just awful. And Hope would sing to Crosby, "There's a ball club in the cellar in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania."
Those guys did a lot of work together.
And Crosby was the crooner, whatever, but he was a technical genius.
Well,
most of what
investments in tape.
Yeah, and changed absolutely the way that music was recorded, understood, and disseminated.
Yep.
Without a doubt.
Well, you know, Hope went to junior high school in Cleveland. His actual name was Lester Robert Hope. Where the kids had went to school with him, like one of my uncles, they called him, instead of Les Hope, it was Hopeless, because he was not.
You
exactly
know, when you start out that way, you're gonna move into, you're almost driven into comedy, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, he owned part of the Indians too, at one time.
Oh, okay. Well, that explains it. Yeah.
Art owner in the tribe. I mean, a lot of he came here. I think he was here when they closed the old stadium. That stadium was built in the 30s for some kind of a. They were taking a half-ass shot at the Olympics and Billy Rose Aquacade and all the show business type stuff. And in fact, the Indians didn't move full time to that stadium probably till 45. And one thing that was done here in Cleveland, you talk about a history maker, DiMaggio came in here with a 56-game hitting streak, and he left with it.
Yeah.
Came in here in this third baseman, Keltner, beat him, threw him out, and Boudreaux. Those were two guys that were really tremendous when I was a youngster. Some of them, a lot of the guys, Feller went to war for at least 3 years, I think. You told me three. I thought two for sure. He was on a, I think he was on a battleship, the South Dakota, maybe. One of those, well, battleships, of course, named after states, so I'm,
yeah.
You know, I'm pushing the memory box, because I'm having trouble with it. I can think, I can sit here 1 minute and remember somebody's name, and the next minute I don't know it anymore. So there was some, there might have been a little damage, but then again, people my age, I have cousins and that, who said, you don't worry about it. It happens to me all. Well, anyway, I'll let you go.
All right, you have yourself a good evening, and we will be talking soon, I hope.
Yeah, well, I try to. You take care.
All right, take care, Bill. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland, and it was just natural that sooner or later a baseball conversation would begin, what with the time of year and everything. Interestingly, and I'd forgotten about this, but it's true, Marty pointing out that Tim Lincecum's dad called Strasburg's injury before it even happened. I think that's right. And of course, one of the other interesting things about Lincecum is that the guy who does the Alabama surgeon who does all the restorative surgery, the so-called Tommy John surgery, said of all the pitchers out there, the one he expects never to see because of the nature of his motion is Tim Lincecum. I didn't know that. Irish Dave pointing out today's fun fact: Cy Young, Denton True Young, started his career with the Cleveland Spiders. How about that? The Cleveland Spiders. Going back to the phones in just a minute. A couple of lines open if you want to jump in for the rest of the conversation. 304-658-3333. A note coming in from Shorty in L.A. Veterans bill update from Bernie Sanders to all Horn family veterans. Read. A disappointed Senator Bernie Sanders pledged to continue to fight for improved benefits for veterans after Senate Republicans on Thursday blocked a vote on comprehensive legislation to expand health care, education, job training, and other programs. Republicans derailed the bill by raising a budget point of order, challenging outlays for veterans. Wow, does that just... Why does that not turn to ashes in their mouths? The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office had said deficits actually would decrease by $1.34 billion over 10 years under the legislation by Sanders. It was a deficit reduction. Oh, my God, the chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. I had hoped from the bottom of my heart that at least on this issue, the need to protect and defend our veterans and their families, we could rise above the day-to-day rancor and party politics that we see here in Congress, said Sanders. Of course, one of the things that probably stymied the Republicans from the story that Shorty sent in. Another provision of the bill would have improved access to care and benefits for veterans who experienced sexual trauma while serving in the military. Can't have that. Can't have that. Just, well, can't. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
So, hey, Bob, how about those homo demons?
Oh, my God. Yeah. See, I've got that in the stack. What's his name? Pastor Reverend James David Manning of Harlem and the Atla World Missionary Church responding to the veto of the gay crow law in Arizona responded. You got to quit laughing long enough so everybody else can laugh too. Responded by putting up a. It's going to get catching here in a minute. He put up a message on the Atla World Missionary Church's message signboard outside the church. You ready for this? Okay. I think we have to have sound effects. Hang on. Stand by.
Obama has released these demons, particularly upon the black males. This homosexual demon, hoping to influence as many black males to subscribe to ideas that homosexual perverted LGBT is possible. No, that wasn't the sign. The sign actually says that Obama has released white homo demons on the black man. Look out, black woman. A white homo may take your man. I know.
When I saw that, because somebody was tweeting about it, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, homo demons? What? So I Googled, and I'm like, oh, no. How can Moran Monday have passed? How?
Why can't this at least happen on prayer meeting Wednesday?
Exactly. I mean,
they're trying to take over the whole blessed show, Tracy.
I mean, because I'm like, this isn't really a thorn in the side or anything like that. Because thorn in the side is when you're making a pain, you're being a pain in the ass to the powers that be. So you can't. Jeez Louise! When I saw that, I had to post it on the Horn page. What could I do?
No, you have to.
I have to. There was nothing I could. Because I couldn't believe it. Because that plus John Mayer saying his penis is racist.
Oh, my. I have noticed, said Reverend Manning, I have noticed that Obama is influencing the few black men that are left to come out of the closet or be homosexual, and they are being scooped up by white homos, leaving the black woman in more dire straits and with less of a choice of a man to come and be her husband and father her children. Wow.
So is that why I'm gay? Because the white homo?
Well, they done scooped up all the good black men
That's the fact that all the good black men and young black men were being scooped up by the prison and death.
Yeah, scooping. Scoops.
You know, and about this bogus war on drugs. You know, if you want to get mad about something. Now, when I saw that this was in Harlem, I said, no, see, this is a joke. You know, because I didn't want the whole thing happening that blow up in my face, like the whole thing about, you know, Michelle Batshit, crazy Bachman. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to actually research it. Or if I don't find it, I'm going to say, it's a joke, people. Don't write on my Facebook page and all this about how can you spread this. No, all these newspapers carried it. I'm like, no, homie, for real?
But that's okay. I mean, let's not pretend that it's just one black preacher up in Harlem losing his mind. He's been losing his mind for a while. You remember when the woman, and I was in D.C. that day, when the D.C. police went wild because of the woman who was sort of freaking out in her car with the baby in the back seat?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this same preacher, Reverend Manning, said that she was the mother of Barack Hussein Obama's love child, and that he had had her shot.
Oh.
I can. Yeah, and people got worked up about Jeremiah Wright.
Oh. At least Jeremiah Wright was speaking the truth.
Yeah, well, right, precisely. But what I was getting at though, Tracy, is let's not pretend for an instant that it's just some crazy black minister. You remember the crazy white minister down in Dallas who said that Mitt Romney was a member of a cult?
Well, he is. He's a Mormon. Oh, no, just kidding.
Yeah, see, there you go. yeah, this would be Reverend Pastor Brother Robert Jeffress of the First Baptist Church of Dallas. Now, this is one of them Baptist churches. I mean, I'm guessing Reverend Manning's got, you know, he's probably kind of like Westboro Baptist. He's got 15 congregants.
They have to have two or three services a Sunday there at that big old Baptist mega church obscenity in Dallas. There's a senior pastor and an associate pastor and a pastor in charge of diddling little children and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pastor Robert Jeffress was asked about what happened in Arizona.
Don't know.
Yeah, I'm not saying he makes Reverend Manning look sane or anything, but you know, this dude's not all home neither. Okay, I promise you. He is not. This just takes a minute.
Marry is not a constitutional right. If the right to marry were a constitutional right, then siblings could marry one another, 15-year-olds could marry one another. Our nation has always recognized the right of states to regulate marriage for the common good.
How do you feel about this ruling today?
Well, I think it is a wrong ruling. As a Christian, I go to the Bible and I see in Genesis chapter 2 and Matthew 19, that God said marriage should be between one man and one woman in a lifetime relationship. And any deviation from that, whether it's adultery, premarital sex, unbiblical divorce, or homosexuality, is wrong.
Now, obviously you're a church leader, and I'm talking to you about a judge's ruling, but this is an issue that you've been pretty outspoken on.
Wait. This isn't necessarily about just Arizona, Tracy. This is about all them homo demons that were let loose in Texas yesterday when the federal judge intruded upon the state's rights and said they was going to have themselves some gay marriage down in Texas. So just to be clear, he'll wrap up real quick here.
Why is it important to you to speak out about this?
Well, as a pastor and as a Christian, the Bible speaks out about it, and
depending on the translation, of course.
Eric and I also realize that no nation can survive that condones what God has condemned. And God has condemned homosexuality just like he does adultery or premarital sex as being wrong. And as a nation, we cannot be blessed by God if we're rejecting God.
So you got to at least be grateful for the fact that while he did compare gay people to fornicators and adulterers and premarital sexers and 15-year-olds getting it on. He didn't compare it. He didn't compare gay people to burglars, rapists, pedophiles, or Hitler.
Well, here's my
question. So we're making progress.
Here's my question, because like the whole, you know, thank goodness that Jan Brewer was like, okay, this is going to cost me a whole lot of money if I sign this bill. And but here's my question. Now, if God is blessing this country, the reason why God isn't blessing this country, because he said that God is continuing to bless this country because people in this country don't participate in fornication, adultery, lying, and stealing.
There's that.
Okay, so then why hasn't this world just blown up? Because if you just go over to Congress and the people who are running shit around here, aren't they a bunch of fornicators, liars, thieves,
warmongers?
Whoremongers, fearmongers, you name the mongers, they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at what happened in, you know, was it Tennessee with the VW plant?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, in the UAW and all that and so forth. And if there wasn't an extreme case, well, it wasn't even an extreme case. It was just, you know,
just,
that wasn't extreme.
Another day.
It is another day of fear-mongering and just in what we call, you know, the United States Congress. So, or Senate, because it was the senator that was sick. So, what? So when they say all these things, and you know, it tickled me so when this whole bill in Arizona came about, because I'm laughing, going, okay, so when a man and a woman check into any hotel in Arizona or a bed and breakfast or what have you, are they going to have to show their marriage license?
Well, they best not be Hispanic because they'll have to show their citizenship papers still, because
right.
You know
right.
That's still on the books.
Well,
and you know, I mean, The NFL is not an organization that particularly impresses me, but at least the NFL was willing to look at him and say, you know what? We'll pull the Super Bowl. On the other hand, Major League Baseball, about whom we were talking just a few minutes ago, had an all-star game in Phoenix about which they said not a word back when the Papers, Please bill was going through.
Mm-hmm. Well, you figure, like, you know, Arizona, you know, besides that, you know, the House bill, whatever it is, don't forget that you can't have any ethnic studies in school there either.
Oh, absolutely not. No. Our buddy Jeff Biggers has written prolifically on that issue.
So, you know, first, I love, I mean, there's only certain parts of Arizona that I will actually step foot in. Flagstaff and Sedona. Those are the only two places. And Sedona's kind of sedity, so not so much. But Flagstaff is an amazing part of Arizona. It's beautiful. It's green. It's up in the mountains. I mean, you got the Grand Canyon and the whole shebang. Anything else? I'm sorry. Fuck Arizona.
Yeah. I mean, just because this happened doesn't. And please, can we observe and remember for a minute? Because somewhere along the way, I think we kind of forgot this, Tracy.
About Columbus Day?
No. Marriage equality is still not a fact in Arizona.
Right.
So they were passing a bill to keep bakers from making cakes for gay couples getting married who still can't get married in Arizona.
Arizona. Hello.
I mean, just saying. Of course, if it can happen in a federal court in Texas, it can happen in a federal court in Arizona. And I cannot. I'll be straight up about this. I can't wait. I really can't.
I might have to go to Gay Pride in Arizona, wherever they have a Gay Pride. And I don't. Like I said, I don't particularly like Arizona, but I mean, it is really close to me. It's like a 6-hour drive, I guess.
And you'll probably get a kick out of this. This is part of, I mean, there has been a no kidding, full on, turbo boosted, kittens with crocheted tails and polka dots hissy had by the right wing over what Jan Brewer did yesterday.
Oh, she?
My favorite.
Oh no.
Comes from Judson Phillips, the president of Tea Party Nation.
Okay.
I trust you. I mean, I trust you're in your cab and you've got the seatbelt on and everything. So I'm
on my way home and I'm stuck in traffic. So go ahead and say it. Go ahead.
He says, because he has no concept whatsoever of American history or sociology or human decency, that the left and the homosexual lobby are both a push in slavery using the Orwellian concepts of tolerance and inclusiveness. So, if you and your beloved get married, that is just like what happened in 12 Years a Slave. Just like. And all the pasty-faced, doughy, and even the dark-skinned folks who are, you know, all up in arms, you know, like Reverend Manning, about gay folks are getting married. If y'all get married, it will be just as though every one of them was kidnapped, taken to a plantation, and left to chop cotton. That's what it's going to be exactly like. Because Teabagging Nation President Judson Phillips done said it.
Sometimes I just wish that somebody would just walk up on these people, slap them in the back of the head and snatch the microphone and say, "Are you fucking kidding me?"
Oh, but it gets better or worse, depending. Yeah. Judson Phillips wasn't done. Should a devote baker be required to create a cake for a homosexual wedding that has a giant
phallic symbol on it? Or should a baker be required to create pastries for a homosexual wedding in the shape of genitalia? Or should a photographer be required to photograph a homosexual wedding where the participants decide they want to be nude or engage in sexual behavior? Would they force a Jewish photographer to work a Klan or Nazi event? How about forcing a Muslim caterer to work a pork barbecue dinner?
See, you gotta make me hang up the phone, Bob. You know, what? First of all, has any of you, any of the horn, and just throwing out, you know, because I can't see the chat room or anything or email because I am driving. But let's just throw out this question to the horn family or the ladies or what have you. Have any women gone to a bridal shower?
I'm reckoning they have.
They have. Candy suckers in the shape of penises, okay?
No, they don't. No, they don't. You quit that. Now, I mean, you're giving up the secret mysteries of womanhood here, and there are men folks that probably can't stay. You might be causing a heart attack somewhere along the way.
My ears, they can't make it.
They make cake with breasts, shaped in breasts.
They make booby cakes.
Yes, they make booby cake. Get the fuck out of here. Booby cake, penis cake.
Yeah, but what I love here is that, and I am sure that Judson Phillips is so straight that, I mean, he the lights are off and the woman is on her back thinking about how she's going to paint the ceiling beige, and they just do it long enough to procreate and for no other reason. But I love how his twisted mind, and it's always this way, Tracy, with these right-wing freaks. The first thing he can think about is a penis-shaped cake.
Right.
Yeah, which part of the cake you want to slice of, Judson, buddy? Mm-hmm. What?
Mm-hmm. What?
Yeah.
I mean, why do they always go to the sex?
Because it's what they think about. It's all they think about.
And it's like, I wish.
Why else was Larry Craig in the men's room in the basement of Minneapolis Airport tapping his toes?
Okay. It's like, I'm sorry. I wish. I could probably have most of my gay friends agree with this. I wish we had as much sex as they think we do. I'm sorry if that freaked anybody out. I'm just saying, it's like most gay relationships are like pretty, you know what? I did the hashtag the other day because I have a lot of her friends are younger than Jan and I. We're still at that point of trying to find people closer to our age or her age or what have you. But typically I'm home, we're home Saturday night, Friday night, 9 o'clock. I get phone calls, hey Tracy, you want to go out? I'm like, no, right? And then I do the hashtag old married couple. Okay? Because, you know, we're like any other couple. We work every day. We're exhausted. Who has the energy to have sex? Again, sorry. But it's like, and so when I hear about all this sex that gay people are supposed to be having, I'm like, well, goddamn. What do I, you know, is there a pill I have to take or something? Okay, shit, I'll stop, Bob, because I can see you dying.
No, that's okay. I mean.
Because there is a pill you could take, but not, I forget there are pills.
Yeah, let's just leave me out of this, okay, Tracy? I mean, just say it.
You know, but I have never understood why they are so obsessed with the sexual activities of gay people. I don't get it. I won't get it. And so I spend most of my time laughing at what I see on the TV and When I saw this one, though, the white homo demons, not just homo demons, Bob, but white homo demons. Aren't you guys tired of messing with black folks?
Yeah, you'd think we would have got our fill of it, but never mind. See,
You're jump right off that cliff. But seriously, why? Oh, why? It's like, dude, of all the people, the white man. Okay, again, if you're going to be pissed off about the things that white people do to black people, again, prison industrial complex, the fake war on drugs, you know, you name it, whatever.
Well, I mean, how many veterans are there who are of color who got completely screwed, blued, and tattooed today by what the Republicans did in the Senate of the United States? Granted, all the veterans got screwed, but a significant subset of that group of all the veterans who got screwed were veterans of color.
So, if you want to get pissed off about what the white man is continually doing to black people, I mean, and I'm not going to take some, because I know there's probably some black, are there still any black Republicans in Congress and in the Senate? Or no? We don't have any black senators anymore, do we?
Yes.
Who?
Right-wing teabagger dude from South Carolina.
Okay. There you go. So I know he was one of the people that signed that, you know, that obstructed that bill.
Yes, he was.
So there you go.
The only two senators who voted for it from the Republican Party were from Nevada and Kansas.
Nevada and where?
Kansas.
Kansas.
Of all places, if you can imagine.
Of all places, Kansas. Wow.
Yeah. By the way, you lit a fire under Tim. And no, he's not pissed off that his room's not open or anything. No, it's about something entirely else. Tim says, wait. When did God condemn anyone for homosexuality? Sodom and Gomorrah? Bullshit. I'm an atheist in the Bible. Ezekiel 16, verse 49, God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah because, quote, now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. Tim says, where does it say homosexuality? And speaking about homosexuality in the New Testament, well, there's Matthew 19, which is what Pastor Jeffress cited. Not everyone can accept this teaching, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let anyone accept this who can. And Tim says, so Jesus accepted homosexuals and not condemning here. Even if the Old Testament says homosexuality is wrong in Leviticus 18, verse 22, which it doesn't necessarily, the New Testament or the New Covenant erases the old law, and according to Matthew, Christians are to accept LGBTQs.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you know what's interesting is, and most people, again, the funny thing about Scripture is that it has a cultural bias. There are things in it that were understood by its original readers that are not understood by us. For instance, that line about there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Well, not too far up the coast in what is now Turkey, there was, I think it was Ephesus. Maybe it wasn't. But one of those ancient cities, and the goddess required that her adherents be castrated.
Ow.
Yeah. And so what they would do is in a drugged and alcohol fogged frenzy, they would castrate themselves. And then they had to carry their jewels with them, running through the streets. And they would then cast their separated testicles at the door of a resident of the city, who then would open the door and accept in the new castrato and nurse him back to health. They had the option, however, of leaving the door closed and letting him bleed to death on the stoop. That is what Jesus is talking about. So he's actually referencing a pagan practice, but saying that it is being done for the kingdom of heaven. You could almost say out of that verse, Jesus was a Unitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, how do we get into spots like this?
Because we like to talk, and we have, I don't know.
Yes, okay, clarification. Will from Chicago pointing out, Bob, you're referring to the cult of Cybele, the great mother. Yes. Yes. Cybele.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Cybele.
So this, you know, so like I said, I just, even before I fell in love with my girl, like I've talked about many times, I had issues with what I was hearing from the pulpit. Now, I can honestly say, like, when I was growing up, nobody ever talked to, not at my church or any other church for that matter that I can recollect. Was there ever anything about people being gay? And so much so that all the way up until high school, I mean, I'm graduating from high school. I'm 18, almost 18 years old. And I had an idea about gay people, but, you know, it was just whatever, okay? It's only been around, the last 20 or so years, or 30? When did this whole blow-up thing about gay people, when did it just get to the point of just idiocy and all the ills or the woes of the world is because of gay people? When did this happen? Was it because of AIDS?
No, it happened because the world looked at them. Remember, the Southern Baptist Church is the Southern Baptist Church, and they've done a little bit of mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, only they don't speak Latin over the last few decades. But the Southern Baptist Church became the Southern Baptist Church because they rejected the end of segregation and the end of Jim Crow and rejected civil rights. I mean, I will never forget, and she was 90 years old when I heard her say it. It was the last time, I guess it was 2007 when I was down in Alabamistan, when this wonderful woman who had been like a second mother to me told me with great pride when I was down there, she said, and you know what, I hope you can come to services while you're down here, because you know what, we have a Negro family in the church now. We've come a long way. And you can argue that they have, but they haven't come far enough. But that's where all this stuff comes from. It became socially unacceptable to stigmatize people for the color of their skin, so therefore we gotta have the next most vulnerable group. And by the way, yes, Tim from L.A. She said Negro, because that was polite, and she was an incredibly polite woman. And at 90, she had not been told about African American or anything. But anyway, I had a query coming in from Isaac. He says, wasn't David of David and Goliath fame gay? Well, it's not so much David of David and Goliath fame, but you can certainly make a pretty telling argument that David of David and Jonathan fame was gay. And David loved Jonathan as his own soul, and Jonathan loved David as his own soul. And Saul was Jonathan's daddy, and Saul got most wroth with David. But he doesn't say why. Except to point out how absolutely upside down, spitting nails mad Saul got with David.
Yeah.
And of course, Jonathan, Saul was the king of Israel, and Jonathan would have been his heir.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Bible Explained people says that Saul was angry because David was more successful in battle. Um, No, I'm guessing not.
Not so much. And who else? There was another one.
Now, okay, I mean this almost sounds like a wedding, right? This is from 1 Samuel 18. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul.
Mm-hmm. I have a, if I was home, I'd get it. It's a book on gay marriages, you know, how to do a gay marriage as far as, you know, if you want this theme, if you want that theme, if you want Chris or whatever. And they point out several chapters in various books in the Bible, I mean, chapters, verses, rather, on, you know, basically gay love. And, you know, like, what one of the verses that Jan and I are going to read at ours is, you know, Ruth, you know, your God, that, you know, whether you go, I will go, your people will be my people. Your God will be my God.
Well, I mean, listen to this. Listen to this. This is the King James Version, which we all know is the language that God speaks, Elizabethan English.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Then Jonathan and David made a covenant. What happens at a wedding?
Uh-oh. Covenant.
Yeah. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him.
Uh-oh.
Now, there's no mention here of disco balls or 138 beats per minute, a second, no. And gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle, which does not mean a foundation garment. It's the thing that holds the sword. And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely, and Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. And it came to pass as they came, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets with joy and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was wroth, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands, and what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. And so that's when things, but it only starts going south after Jonathan strips himself of the robe that was upon him and gives it to David and all of his garments, even to his sword and his bow and to his girdle. Because what Jonathan is doing is Jonathan is saying to his daddy, I love this man more than I love the idea of being the next king of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am seriously loving this man. I mean, you know, cue up this man of mine loving this
right.
man.
Pass help loving this man of mine.
A note coming in from Irish Dave. Damn you, Bob. Now we are all Bible curious, my friend. Bible,
sorry,
Bible curious.
Bible
get it?
Bible curious. But, you know, my favorite book in the Bible is the Song of Solomon. I'm telling you, there's some stuff in there. Like,
that is dirty.
Ooh, it is dirty. It is dirty. Have you ever noticed that in church you very rarely hear people reading from the Song of Solomon?
Well, the other thing they never preach on is the part where Lot's daughters decide to get him liquored up and get it on with Daddy.
Right. And see, that's okay. Exactly. They don't talk about that. They got it on with Dad, you know, and it's all because that's the reason why Sodom was destroyed, was because they were not hospitable.
Oh, and by the way, Horzak reminding me, don't forget, David had this knack for collecting foreskins.
Ew! What?
Oh, yeah.
See, that's just nasty.
Yes, it is.
That's just nasty.
But that's the conversation we had back at the turn of the new year that got so many people all worked up. So we'll stay away from that.
Yeah, oh, God. Oh, God. But see, okay, if you take the Bible and read it as literature, there's some interesting stuff in there. Me, personally, I follow, you know, I use the Bible. I mean, there's some people I say, okay, read it as a work of fiction, literature, what have you. I take it as a guide, okay, of how I should act. because there have been so many things that have happened to me in my life that I can only attribute to miracles and only attribute to by faith in God that I have gotten through the things that I have gotten through. And I loved it when I went back to school as an adult, and I had one of my English lit teachers basically say, you know, that the Bible was a bunch of Hebrew, Jewish fables, not to be believed. And I said, well, that may be the case for you, but never discount somebody's faith. Because especially when you have somebody that's, you know, new to school or what have you, and they're trying to, you know, trying to find their identity, and they believe in the Bible, and then you have somebody say, oh, that's just a bunch of bullshit, that can mess with people. It really could. And if I was younger when he said that, I would have been like, well, maybe I'm, because academics equate faith with being stupid. If you believe in the Bible, then you're not an intelligent person. And I'm like, no, I could be intelligent and believe in the Bible.
Well, yeah, but there's the difference between the literal literal application and the literary interpretation.
Exactly.
I mean, there's a difference between thinking there really was a Cain who slew his brother and then went out and married some woman who wasn't a daughter of Eve, which meant there were other people on. There's that literal interpretation. And then if you look at the fact, for instance, that Abel brings a burnt sacrifice to God, an animal sacrifice that he has, you know, he's gone out and hunted and slayed, and then Cain brings him a nice crudité platter with some broccoli and cauliflower and carrots and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And some balsamic vinegar ranch.
Absolutely, it ain't worth it with that, and the ranch.
And my God. Okay, I'm about to flip it to food porn.
But anyway, you can look at that and say that really happened, at which point it doesn't have a hell of a lot of meaning, except to show that people were brutal early on. Or you can look at it and say, we've got a guy who's bringing vegetables to the altar and a guy who's bringing meat that he has hunted down. Could this possibly be an allegory for the inherent conflict in the cultural changes that are taking place as a society transforms from a hunter-gatherer society into a sedentary agricultural society? And that one makes a hell of a lot more sense.
Look, I look at this. I'm looking at, like, you know, I question a lot of stuff. As the older I get, the more I question. And, you know, I think I told you, you know, like we were saying months back about the Bible, it's not a history book, folks. I mean, I remember.
Yeah, but see, you can say that, and that means that a whole bunch of thousands and thousands and millions of fundamentalist Christians in this country just know by you saying that you are on the way to hell.
Mm-hmm. But here's my question. I mean, remember, because you go to the museums and you see the dinosaurs, the Cro-Magnon man and all that. None of that was in the Bible. I remember.
Who did not hang out together, we might add.
No. Remember going into the Bible as a kid, looking in Genesis for talking about the dinosaurs. I'm like, okay, where is it? I know that. I mean, I think I actually asked somebody, where do the dinosaurs fit in the Bible? If this is not a history book, if it's supposed to be a history book, if this stuff actually really happened, I mean, I personally believe it does. It did, okay? But that's just me. But then again, I believe in science also. So, there's a disconnect, because, again, there's dinosaurs, there's evolution, I mean, there's all these things that predate the Bible, supposedly. So, where's all this stuff happening? And I think that's how a lot of people, when they go to school, lose their faith, because they hear what the professor's saying about science and, you know, the ooze or the Big Bang and all this. And then they're like, but Mom, Dad, how does this fit in the Bible? And so there you go. That's why you have all these people not wanting kids to learn about science, because then people will start questioning. And we can't have that. Am I making sense or am I rambling?
No, you're doing fine. By the way, Isaac points out because he's intrigued with this David and Jonathan story. Isaac points out that according to 1 Samuel 23:16-18, David and Jonathan had a secret meeting together in the forest, and they too made a covenant before the Lord.
Oh, so it was the first gay marriage?
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's the first royal gay marriage.
See, here's my thing. Again, people, please use the Bible as a guide of how you should act, as a way of teaching people or what have you. But don't, please God, use it as a history book.
Or a club.
Or a cult. Or, you know, or use it as, yes, a club to beat people down with. Because, you know, you had atrocities done in the name of Jesus during the crusade, okay, I'm doing history as Tracy Porter knows it, and then we fast forward a few thousand years or hundreds of years, and then we get slavery, and we get that justified by the Bible, and then you have women being used as property because it's justified by the Bible. So one of my ministers at the church said, and kind of like what you said, because you can't really talk about black people. You can't say this about black people. You can't say this about women. You can't say this about whomever. So now we got to figure out who we can oppress, and we got to by using the Bible. Oh, okay. I'm about to be really mean. Not really mean, but really bad. Who have you? You saw the movie Harlem Nights, right?
Oh yeah, long time ago.
Okay, now I'm about to say something really dirty, and then I'm going to get off the phone.
Well, okay, if it has to be that way.
Well, not get off, but get off. Anyway, so remember when they were talking about the prostitute or rather the woman, they called her Sunshine because her was so good that she threw it up in the air in the sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
And then fast forward that her JJ was so good that it made the man change God. Okay, Jan converted to Christianity.
we'll just take the implications from there.
Right, and so but it was so funny because I was talking to a friend of mine because Harlem Nights is like one of our all time favorite movies. We can almost quote the movie chapter and verse. Okay, and so when I said that, my friend and I laughed. We laughed for a good 20 minutes, just laughing, because Jan has only seen Harlem Nights one time, and the humor was just too much for her to take, so she didn't, so she didn't really watch the movie all the way through. So, when I thought about that, and I just said, oh my God, just call me Sunshine. Call me Sunshine. Because I got not to being a Jew to a Christian.
What are we going to do with you?
Well, you know you love me.
We absolutely do. Absolutely.
And so when I say stuff, I can see everybody in the chat room shaking their heads like, oh, my God. But it's just,
Well, had I been forewarned, I could have had the Madeline Kahn scene from Young Frankenstein where she sings Sweet Mystery of Life, At Last I Found You.
Yeah.
It's twoo. It's twoo.
Twoo.
Yeah, that's, of course, Blazing Saddles.
That's Blazing Saddles. So it's like...
Honey, I am not from Havana.
Baby. Oh, God.
Yeah, it's baby, isn't it? It's not honey. It's baby.
Yeah, I'm not from Havana.
Oh, mercy.
Well,
we try so hard to do a serious little radio program here.
Okay, and I have one more question, and I'm really going to go because Jazz is blowing up my phone.
Okay.
But when is Dr. Bill on the air? or what have you, because I would really love to call into the show once, or I don't know. I just, how do I find him?
Okay, he is live from 1 to 3 p.m. Pacific time, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. Sometimes he's noon to 2 because he has other obligations, but mostly it would be 1 to 3 Pacific time.
And how do I find the show? Or
just same old stream you listen to here.
Oh, okay. Okay. So he's okay. Okay, because I would really...
His podcasts are also available at White Rose.
Oh, I know, but I would like to hear the show live.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I've...
So is that during your work hours?
Yeah, but I drive a cab, so, you know, I can do whatever I want, like,
Right.
Unless I have a customer, but...
I did drop you an email the other day.
Good.
As per our previous conversation. And tweeted you the article I put up at the Horn site. If you want to print that out and share it.
I'm excited.
Okay,
because
good.
I really wanted to try to see what I could do because there's, I have two projects that I'm going to start working on, and you know, one is the talk on slavery. And post-traumatic slave syndrome, and white privilege, and what it has, and what it is currently doing to this country. I was listening to this guy on the radio the other day talk about how racism is killing white America. He was saying back during, during World War II, World War One, one of the wars, who knows, how racism was so entrenched that there was, you know, black men who had given blood for the blood bank, and white men would not take, they would rather bleed to death and die.
Oh, yeah, because they were afraid that, you know, that, yeah, you know, that was going
to
happen.
And to me, I'm just like, well, if that's the truth, I thought what they say about black people, you know, wouldn't you want to be a white man to get some black blood? Because of what? I was talking about rhythm, Bob.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Would that be the rhythm method?
The rhythm method, exactly. On that note, I am going to go. I love you guys, and be safe out there. And, Bob, stop, and any of them, my brothers out there listening, my black men, be careful of the white homo
demons. The white homo demons.
Because they're coming after you. And, you know, I don't want to be held responsible for turning, you know, because I didn't warn you. And I'm just, you know, because I
can't. I know. And then there's the volcanoes and the earthquakes and terrorist attacks.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that, like, my June wedding, summer solstice, somebody actually asked me if I was a pagan. I said, you know, there's some things about paganism that I can work with. So, yeah, whatever. You know, whatever works. I'm at that point in my life where I am welcoming of all faiths, as whatever it does to keep you going.
Well, John Lennon said it best, whatever gets you through the night.
Whatever gets you through the night. And, you know, if you believe, you know, in whatever belief, whatever, I don't care. As long as you're not hurting me, anybody else, kids, or animals. Cruelty. I mean, I'm not talking about, like, as a sacrifice, you know, as a part of your religious sacrifice. So all you Santeria folks and, you know, whomever.
Yeah, Tracy's not coming after the Santerians.
No, I'm not. If animal sacrifice is part of your religion, I am not tripping with you, boo. Voodoo, whatever. Not tripping with you, boo. Just do what you do. Okay?
Do that voodoo that you do so well. Yes.
That voodoo that you do.
Yeah, there's that great line from the that movie that had Cary Grant and a more grown-up Shirley Temple, and there's a word gag that runs through it, and it's, you remind me of a man. What man? The man with the hoodoo. Hoodoo. You do. What? Remind me of a man. What man? The man with the, yeah.
The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer.
Yes! By God, yes it is. And it's a wonderful little movie. Tracy, have a wonderful evening.
You have a wonderful evening, Bob, and good night and God bless.
Thanks.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. Tracy, the lady cab driver, got some phone calls to work through here, and we will try to as best we can. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Will from Chicago here. Call in and remind people that the forum does not just one run off of sharp and witty conversations. That if you feel so moved to support the network, please do so. And since it's my birthday, if you want to give me a gift, please keep Bob on the air, because what you do is not easy, and you don't have billions of dollars being funneled into your post office box, would that were so.
That is so true, and let me stop everything and say happy birthday, Will.
Thank you. Some observations. Concerning the Republican members of the Senate who blocked veterans benefits in dealing with that, I would call them moral cowards, except that to call them a coward would probably be too much praise. I mean, look at it this way. Generally, what the Republican Party emphasizes is the role of business. And in business, making a contract and sticking to it is supposed to be, to Republicans, one of the major things that a government does, because you need the courts to enforce contracts. Even Ron Paul will agree with that. In fact, to him, that's the primary role.
Well, sure. I mean, the right of contract is the most sacred thing to which Ron Paul can refer outside of Aqua Buddha. Or,
right.
I'm sorry, that's Rand.
Right. So, from looking at this, as Ron Paul, as the Republicans are in violation of keeping the social contract with the veterans, are they not in actuality in defiance of their own core principles? Since if you make an agreement, you are supposed to stick with it, but instead these spineless Republicans are essentially saying to the veterans, well, you'd rather like use tissue paper. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Enough of what Lindsey Graham had to describe last night.
Very well done.
But I think that what would be nice to see is if Graham and some of the other Republicans could get serious challenges simply because they deserve them. I'm pleased to see that Mitch McConnell is now very worried about his future, both from the left and from the right.
Yeah, he's got plenty to worry about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he has to worry that he won't be taken down in the primary and then won't be so damaged that he loses to a Democrat. I'd love to see him dragged out of the Senate crying because he has no more power. Now, mind you, he'd be very happy as a lobbyist.
Maybe he could get a position at the American Enterprise Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, or any one of the God knows thousands of right-wing think tanks that crop up every day in Washington.
Yes, I mean, there's...
Because, I mean, Jim Demented has the Heritage Foundation nailed up.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure a position can be found for him, but I think what we are seeing is people are finally getting tired of the nonsense. We're seeing it with Moral Mondays in North Carolina and people like Reverend Barber, who is a far better representative of the teachings of one Jesus of Nazareth than the weird pastor in Harlem with the sign, which makes me wonder.
Or the weird pastor in Dallas.
Oh, yes, yes. There are some who definitely remind me of Gandhi's adage, I love your Christ, but I don't love your Christians.
They're so unlike your Christ.
Yes, yes, because how would I say it? I could see Reverend Barber, if he had been a young man alive at the time, of having been recruited directly by Dr. King and walking on that bridge in Selma. I do not see too many like the two pastors we mentioned in Dallas and Harlem having the moral courage to walk that bridge, to stand with people of many faiths and none, many ages from young to old, and face down the billy clubs water hoses in the docks.
Nope.
And this is what I think is something that we forget for all the childhood power of the right wing. At the end of the day, they do not really have very much courage.
No. I was thinking the other day that we have largely forgotten that phrase that was so much in use during the war crimes that were committed against the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. We have forgotten the term "will chicken hawk."
Yes, and that is appropriate because what the GOP generally wants us to do is to be afraid, to think that we have no power. But once we start pushing it, I mean, we can achieve a lot. Chain CBI is gone. The TPP is, Joe Biden admitted, is not going to pass. And there was
it's not going to get fast-tracked.
Oh, it's not going to get fast-tracked, and Harry Reid knows it's a poison pill. And Harry Reid, for all of his weaknesses, will act to save his own career and those of his colleagues. And I think what we have to remember is we have to wake up and remember that we are strong, that while the Republicans may be working with billions of dollars, we can have millions of people active, not just in marches, although those can be important, but in speaking out on issues, educating neighbors, such as you do here on the Horn.
Right, and sometimes you can agitate and you can march and you can do all that, but ultimately you have to have a piece of legislation that brings all of that into one place and codifies it, Will. I mean, how many times do we have to see this process in action? The entire mine wars history of Appalachia and particularly West Virginia, the Battle of Blair Mountain ends in the absolute brutal suppression of the United Mine Workers and all attempts to organize labor in West Virginia, and only bears fruit when the Congress under FDR passes the National Labor Relations Act.
Right.
And then the same thing happens. You've got the Montgomery bus boycott. You've got the lunch counter sit-ins. You've got the Selma to Montgomery march. You've got fire hoses in Birmingham. People turning out to draw national attention to something, but it only changes when a law is passed and signed into law, in this case the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
Right. So Robinson left you on alternate had an article, Six People You Need to Start a Revolution, and she mentioned there's a need for outside agitators and inside allies, and we need to have both. We need to have our Elizabeth Warrens, Bernie Sanders, and others, not just on the national level, but on the local level, and similarly we need pressure from the outside. There's a story about FDR, perhaps apocryphal, that someone came to him with a wonderful pro-labor proposal. He said, okay, I agree with you. Now you have to make me do it, meaning we
right.
have to provide pressure and support.
And see, Barack Obama tried some of that, Will, but and he even referenced that particular quote. But the thing is, the pressure has been there. He just hasn't done it. And, you know, is that a measure of the pressure being insufficient? Or is that a measure of absolute unwillingness? I don't know the answer.
I don't think we perhaps will ever know, but in the end, we have to be strong on our positions, simply because, in the end, if we want that country, we're going to have to rely on ourselves, like the old story in the Talmud about the guy planting a tree whose neighbor comes up to him and says, "The Messiah is here, the Messiah is here." We're best off just doing the everyday work, planting the tree, then dusting off our hands when we're done and say, okay, let's go see this Messiah of yours.
Right. And you know, that same idea is reflected in a number of traditions. There's that great Buddhist quote that says, "Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water," and I have Dr. John to thank for that one, because you know, enlightenment doesn't necessarily mean that suddenly everything is okay, and the coming of Messiah doesn't mean that everything is immediately okay.
Right. I like to say if we want a better world, we are the ones who have to build it, because if not, who else? Rather than expecting deliverance, we can at least do what Dr. King did, which was being inspired by noble words and thoughts from many traditions, go forth and do the words so that at the end of the day, those who come after us will have a better world. It's up to us. Support the Horn. Support the ACAC. Please reference the Horn site for more on the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act and bug your Congress critters. And have a great night, Bob.
Thank you, Will. And again, happy birthday, my friend.
Bye.
Take care. Our buddy Will calling from Chicago. We are just flat out of time. We will have lots more conversation tomorrow evening, because tomorrow evening is, of course, Friday on the Front Porch, to which you are cordially invited. Thank you to everyone for all the help this evening. It has been a big deal to both take care of tonight and a chunk of tomorrow. It's how we remain on the air and viable. Thank you very much to Darlene for getting it started. Thanks to Paul for his contribution early in the day. Thanks to Jason, who pointed out that he sent two of his sons to fight the Republican war in Afghanistan as a result of the poverty draft we were talking about earlier. Thank you to Lottie. Thanks very much to Gordon, who helped out as well. It is all, it's just deeply inspiring. Thank you, one and all. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. John was giving me a couple of lessons in operating the Horn blog during the program. Thank you, John. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.